Hello, this is Katie Merlois.
And I'm Polly Scattergood.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Our special guest is Jim Sklavounos, who, as well as his own brilliant solo projects and recent collaborations with Nicole Atkins and our very own Polly Scattergood, has also been in bands such as Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Sonic Youth, Teenage Jesus and the Jerks. He was a longtime prime mover in New York City's vibrant underground music scene and still creates adventurous new works. Polly's new EP, In the Absence of Light, being an example of one. The focus of today's episode is going to be about cultural scenes and their benefits to us artists. Jim was right at the heart of the No Wave movement. For those of our listeners who might not be familiar with No Wave, No Wave was a seminal cultural music movement in the late 70s, born in New York, which gave birth to alternative rock, with bands such as Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, Swans and Suicide, then later on Sonic Youth.
Welcome to The Detail. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me, Polly Scattergood, in my studio at home. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to show your support. The address is patreon.com/Polly Scattergood. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm just over the moon to be speaking with you, and I know we're going to have a great time, the three of us. But I want to actually start and ask, could you tell us what it was like during the early No Wave days? Paint a picture of New York in that time, that's possible.
I'll try to paint the picture. You know, New York was legendarily a filthy and dangerous place in those days. And that you know, whatever stories you might have heard, they weren't really exaggerations at all. I can't think of a single story that wasn't plausible. It didn't matter what walk of life you were from, where you lived. All parts of the city were equally dangerous, and the city government was on the verge of bankruptcy at one point. We weren't getting any help from the federal government, and there was a general sense of nihilism in the air. Mind you, this was also at the sort of the height of the disco era. So there was also an air of decadence in the air, and overindulgence, and living like there was no tomorrow. And that played in also to the sort of punk movement, which burgeoned around that same time. Well, No Wave was a little bit of a reaction to the punk movement. Whether intentionally or not, we were more nihilistic than punk. And we were certainly a lot more experimental than punk. Our music was a lot more experimental than punk music because it was a lot more dissonant. It was a lot more aggressive. We never felt like the punk music that we were exposed to ever lived up to the sort of sense of rage and anxiety and hardness that we were feeling at that time. So that was a lot of that was a reaction to, you know, our environment. You name it. There was garbage in the streets, drug addicts everywhere, slums, Son of Sam. You know, we our cup runneth over when it came to urban decay.
So where were you living at this point, Jim?
Well, if you call it living, I was born in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
And Brooklyn was pretty much a different place than the Brooklyn people know these days. Brooklyn was sort of a no man's land as far as a lot of people were concerned. If Manhattan was dangerous, Brooklyn was that much worse.
Wow.
You know, and you stood just as good a chance of being held up at gunpoint. You stood just as good a chance of having a gun pointed at you by a criminal as a cop. You know, it was like, it was
really?
Just the atmosphere was very feverish all the time.
I'm
not exaggerating. Before I was 24, I had a gun pointed at me, you know, either being held up or whatever, about 10 times, and half of those times was by the cops. In fact, you felt a lot more in danger from
I can see
when a
why there was a
cop
range.
Was pointing a gun at you.
Uh-huh.
So, but you know, I mean, also I was young and you know, young and foolish and reckless and slightly crazy.
Oh,
so, and bit trigger happy in my brain, as it were. You know, so. I probably, you know, being a tall guy and stuff, probably, you know, whoever saw me that, you know, might have perceived a threat, maybe, you know, because I was tall and slightly deranged looking.
There was a clear need for why there was a desire to have music that represented the feelings of what was going on at that time. But then, you know, the scenes you describe seem very... very tough. How did that then flow into, okay, well, we're going to get together, you know, as musicians? And I mean, was it rehearsed or was it mainly improvised? Like, how did it go from this is our surroundings, you know, and now we're going to form bands?
Well, let me start by saying, you know, socially, you know, the CBGB's Club 82, Max's Kansas City kind of circuit of venues, it was, you know, full of misfits, people who didn't really feel like they belonged, you know, to the disco scene or the or didn't identify with the arena rock bands or just were looking for something to do, you know, that was on a more you know, there wasn't a lot of money around, so people, you know, that liked music formed bands, and it was very easy to play. Basically, it was very easy to play in venues like CBGB's and Max's once they got going. You know, they kind of cultivated a scene because there was so many musicians, and there was such enthusiasm for forming bands that it just kind of naturally happened. It wasn't forced at all. I guess famously, television kind of convinced Tilly Crystal to start putting on bands at CBGB's, and Max's already had like a history with rock bands dating back to, you know, its association with Andy Warhol. And then when the promoter Peter Crowley started booking bands there like Suicide, the tone of the bookings took on a different kind of flavor. More in keeping with the punk movement of the time. As far as the no wave bands go, I think a lot of them, you know, some were already musicians with aspirations, like James Chance, you know, who came from Milwaukee and played the sax and kind of. Basically, I think he came to New York, I think, to, you know, become a jazz musician in the loft jazz scene. And that didn't happen, really, because James's approach to the sax was maybe too peculiar even for the avant-garde jazz movement. Plus, he had other interests. He really loved James Brown and funk music. And Lydia Lunch, well, she was a groupie, you know. She wasn't she wasn't a musician until the day she decided she was a musician. And then she was a musician. And Lydia had, like, you know, very strong concepts and a very strong sense of identity and purpose. And, you know, okay, well, you know, the CBGBs and Max's Kansas City scenes, they weren't hostile to women. But, you know, women were maybe a bit considered a bit secondary, you know, and not given as much respect. I mean, I think any respect that came to Debbie Harry via Blondie was rather belated, you know. Patti Smith was iconic, but and very much celebrated, but, you know, one was enough. And you know, you had people like Tina Weymouth playing bass, but, you know, because her style was so minimal, she wasn't, you know, maybe taken as seriously as some other more conspicuously muso male bass player. So, you know, it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't hostile, but there wasn't a lot of, you know, support, in generally speaking. And you had to be, you know, I think as a woman, you had to be a sort of strong personality if you wanted to do something other than the rock chick cliches, you know?
Yeah.
And Lydia was very much not the rock chick cliches.
Uh-huh.
And I had a magazine called No Magazine. I had a band as well called Mimi and the Dreamboats. And they, frankly, it was a pretty shit band. But I was the singer, and we did our audition nights at CBGB's, blah, 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 you know. But the real thing I was interested in was going to see bands. So we formed this fanzine called No Magazine, which some people think maybe that's the first use of word no in association with a musical movement. I don't know if that's really... I don't know if that's really accurate, but anyway, we were called No Magazine, mm-hmm. and we started covering a lot of the bands that were associated with what later became known as No Wave. And one of those bands was Lydia Lunch, and Lydia Lunch's band, Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, and which I really was fascinated by the band and by Lydia's sort of... completely unapologetic aggressiveness. Mm. And so when I heard that James Chance was, you know, who was a member of the band at that time, when I heard he was leaving, I offered my services as a sax player.
Wow.
And Lydia just said, "No, I don't want any sax in the band. I need a bass player. I'm firing the bass player. You're going to play bass." Which I didn't know how to play either instrument, so it didn't really matter. But I was always game, you know. That was part of the punk DIY thing, you know. If you just because you weren't expert or even, you know, in the least bit knowledgeable about your instrument didn't hold you back from, like, you know, it was all about attitude and enthusiasm and energy. So, and that carried over into the No Wave thing. So like I was saying before, I think a lot of the musicians were kind of had some background, but also by the same token, probably just as many in the No Wave scene were picking up their instruments for the first time.
And for those that might be interested, are these the magazine that you formed? Are they archived at all, or is it possible to view some of them if our listeners are interested?
They're extremely rare. There's the fourth issue, which was like kind of a sort of a deconstructed magazine, is a gallery owner who's selling a copy for a couple of thousand dollars.
Wow.
So I mean, intention, my hope is that I'm going to, when this pandemic is over, I'm going to be able to rally my fellow No staffers, as it were, and we're going to maybe put out a book with with, you know, reproductions of the magazine, but also with extra stuff that never, that we had from the time that never appeared in any of the magazines.
So, wow. Jim, you later joined Sonic Youth. How was that experience different to the other bands that you were in?
Well, the New York scene had already changed quite a bit by that point, but not nearly enough for a band like Sonic Youth to be accepted. So they were very much considered a outsider band still. Them and the band Swans were sort of in a similar boat. They could get gigs, and they did get gigs, but they never had very big crowds. But what Sonic Youth did have was a good alliance with Glenn Branca, the composer, the avant-garde composer Glenn Branca. And Glenn was very supportive, and he gave them every opportunity he could. And I think Thurston and Lee and possibly Kim too, I'm not sure, they all played in his guitar orchestra pieces from time to time. So the arts community, which was always, which kind of, let me backtrack a little bit. There was this sort of seminal event called the Artist Space Festival. Mm. And it was, Artist Space was a gallery, like it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And they mounted a little festival of downtown bands. And it included all of the No Wave bands, Mars, Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, the Contortions, DNA, and then some of the bands that we kind of sometimes a little bit sneeringly called the Soho bands. That was Theoretical Girls, which was Glenn Branca's band, and a few others. I was in one of those Soho bands called the Gynecologists.
Great name.
And that was actually at that event, two sort of key things happened. One was that's when Lydia invited me to join her band.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Provided I lose my virginity to her.
No. Oh my God, was that really the deal?
That was the deal, yeah. The other thing was that Brian Eno was in attendance, and he saw all these bands, and they were all very interesting bands. I wish I could remember the names of all of them. And there was another one, Boris Police Band, who was one guy who played violin and spoke through some sort of megaphone or something. Anyway, Brian Eno saw all these bands, and he wanted to make an album, uh-huh. a compilation album with all these bands. And allegedly, Lydia and James convinced him to trim it down to just four bands, the four bands that appear on the album No New York, mm-hmm. Which Island Records put out and promptly buried. that sort of gave the movement an identity and a momentum and a sort of a credentials because of Brian Eno's endorsement that suddenly made that movement real. And that's something that by the time Sonic Youth came along, there people had kind of gotten used to the idea of this downtown art, noise, rock component of the city's music scene, and were a little bit more accepting of it, even if it still wasn't really, wasn't quite a room clearer, but it wasn't the hot ticket uh-huh. either. So Sonic Youth, the first album was put out, in fact, by Glenn Branca on his own label, which was called Neutral Records. And he put out first an EP with the drummer at that time was the actor Richard Edson, who you may have seen in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, among other 80s classics. Uh-huh. And I was the second drummer. I played on most of the album until I quit.
Jim, I mean, this is what I'd also love to discuss with you. And we were, you know, me and Polly were thinking about this, you know, when we were planning for this interview. To actually talk about the benefits of movements, you know, and cultural scenes in music. And I think it comes definitely, you know, reading about the no wave scene, it feels very much in contrast to today's society, when people are so far apart and culture on the general gets consumed quite separately. You know, so, I mean, I know you've explained, you know, how it was that no wave started. It was, you know, because of what was going on in New York City, you know, because of the absolute hardships there, and also, you know, the reaction to punk over in the UK. You know, but I'm just curious, you know, do you feel there are benefits to creating a musical scene, you know, and how perhaps would one do that?
Let me just clarify something. Punk was a reactionary movement in itself, but the no wave scene was more of a reaction to the local New York punk scene than to English punk. English punk was only available in New York in very rare doses. Very few bands came over initially. The Damned and Wire were two of the earliest bands that came over, and The Jam. But the New York scene was already kind of had already started without really identifying itself as punk per se. Long before the New York punk scene became a really kind of clued in about what was happening in England. I'm not saying that it was happening necessarily earlier. I don't really know, you know, timelines. What difference does it make? But it was very much involved in itself, and the no wave bands were a reaction somewhat to that local scene. And I think that's the key thing about scenes, is that it needs locality. You need like a place, a sense of place to have a scene. And I think also scenes tend to thrive when they are reacting to something, you know, in their environment, you know. Whether it's a positive reaction or a negative reaction, it doesn't really matter. It still needs that sort of thing to sort of set itself against, so that it can form an identity.
Yeah, and pull everyone together
as a collective, you know. Because otherwise, it's just individuals and individual groups doing their own thing. But where you get the sense of a scene is when there's not just when you find that you have common ground, but also that you have a common enemy or a common cause, to put it more neutrally.
That's really interesting.
And that's very hard to do online, you know?
It takes
a different shape online. I think you get groups forming very easily online, but you don't get scenes because you don't as much as you're socially interacting, you know, in real time, even you don't ever have that sort of firm anchoring sense of geography that this is our turf and we're going to defend it. You know, it's much more abstract, so you don't ever really get people laying claim to something in the same way. You know, they can lay claim to their Facebook group and the and the rules that govern it, but they don't, they can't really say, okay, we're going to put on a show here, and it doesn't matter if, you know, we don't sell any tickets, we got something to say.
Well, that's so interesting, because it explains why I've never been able to create a scene, because I live in a very posh part of London, and I find it difficult to identify my enemies.
Well, rest assured, Katie, they're all around you. You just haven't been able to peel their masks
exactly.
off yet.
Very true.
So, Jim, you're now a longtime member of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Yeah.
Nick has one of the most distinctive artistic visions, but you yourself are also incredibly visionary and very prolific as a songwriter as well. How do you all write as a band together? How does that work, the dynamics?
Well, obviously Nick is very capable of writing on his very own.
Uh-huh,
but,
sure.
You know, when you've been Nick Cave as long as you have been, I can imagine that every now and then you want... you want something else, you know, something to bounce off of. And when we had the band Grinderman, the offshoot band Grinderman, that was very much about trying to do something different from the Bad Seeds without the burden of the history of the importance of the Bad Seeds hanging over it. You know, it was an opportunity to be a bit more flippant, but also be a bit more experimental. And then what came out of that, you know, where Grinderman was very much a collective writing situation where we all pretty much always wrote everything all together on the basis of, for lack of a better word, jams. We would jam.
Okay.
We would jam.
So you'd all be in the room together.
Yeah, we'd be playing for hours and hours and hours. And then, you know, every now and then there'd be something like very cool would happen. And that would be the thing we'd cut out of the recording and say, okay, this is going to be the basis for a song. And the thing that helped that too was that Nick was very good at improvising lyrics and improvising his singing. So it already, you know, when you've got all those kind of elements together, it already feels like more than, you know, just a jam. It feels like you're creating music spontaneously in an organized way, even though it's only a sort of an illusion of organization. But when you've played together as long as we have, we were all members of the Bad Seeds for quite some time by the time of Grinderman. So when you've played together that long and under so many different circumstances, you already have a kind of an innate instinct for for working together, for knowing how to kind of prompt people, how to when to shift gears. It's nothing verbal. It's nothing that you have to kind of state. You just know it. You know, the same way I knew that I had to wear a suit without anybody telling me. You know, I think when people join the Bad Seeds, when musicians join the Bad Seeds, it's kind of expected of you to know what you're meant to do. You know, Nick's not going to sit there and explain it to you in agonizing detail, that's for sure. So if you look at the members of the band over the years, you know, the lineup has changed quite a bit. But from the very beginning, you had someone like Blix Bargeld in the band, who, if nothing else, he's clearly a very individualistic person. Mm-hmm. and all the late Conway Savage, you know, he was coming from a very different place musically than a lot of the other band members. But, you know, he brought his individuality into this mix, and the sort of the beauty of the Bad Seeds is that it manages to somehow assimilate all these very diverse personalities and styles. And you know, even if you look at of the nationalities, I mean, there's always been, you know, there's always been a diversity of nationalities: English, Australian, German, Swiss, American, you know. Mm. So it's a melting pot.
it really is a exquisite thing, you know. And you know, one of my favorite records, as is the case for many people, is Boatman's Call. And so I was curious if you remember those recordings and what the atmosphere was like during those days.
Yeah, I remember it very well. And it was all only my second record that I was making with them. And, you know, the first one we had made together, Murder Ballads, was much more of a free-for-all. It was very very improvisatory in the studio. A lot of the, like, for example, Stagger Lee was a very impromptu thing that, you know, I had this book of basically pimp hustler poetry that I brought to Nick, and I said, oh, well, it was like the last day of the recordings, and I was like, well, I guess it's too late, but, you know, I thought you might enjoy some of these poems in here. And there's one in particular called Stagger Lee that's very obscene and violent. And he took a look at it, and, you know, within minutes we were in the recording studio, back in the recording studio, laying down literally a couple of takes of the song, and it was the second take that's on the album. So it wasn't, you know, not a lot of forethought went into that. Whereas with Boatman's Call, Nick had been in rehab, and he had been writing a lot of songs on his own, and it was very, there was a, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, a lot of the songs were somewhat confessional and personal on that album, and a lot more revealing than some of his songs had been in the past. And that required a very different kind of band attitude. We had to make a lot of room for that, and, you know, be very conscious that, you know, it wasn't a free-for-all. It wasn't like, you know, the songs were going to work best if they were naked, kind of, you know, raw and minimalist and allowing for a certain kind of focus on Nick without it being our usual raucous accompaniment. So it was very held back, but everybody was sort of super focused the whole time. We were always, I think it was the first time I'd ever been in a session where the listening was so intensive.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I mean, we would just listen and listen and listen. We did a lot more listening than playing. And because we were looking for that kind of really special balance of, like I said, rawness and intimacy. Yeah.
It feels so honest. It feels like such an honest album.
Fragility and honesty, and, you know, it's very easy to lose that. It's very easy to, but we also needed it to be precise. It couldn't be sloppy, you know? So the band kind of stepped back a bit, you know, and, you know, made more room for Nick to be kind of quite revealing of himself. And again, it was that sort of thing with the bad seeds, is you had to, it was kind of expected of you to know what you're meant to be doing. Right.
So very instinctive.
Nobody said, hey, band, step back. It was more like, we just used our ears and we could hear that's what the songs required. And that's what we did.
Would you do, if I may ask, would you do, I don't know, a few takes, or was it that improvisational style? And then you would go into a control room and listen back very carefully to what had just been done, or was that maybe done a few days later?
There were some demo sessions where things were a bit more improvisational in terms of the band arrangement, like the head arrangement that the band was playing. But Nick had already come to those demo sessions with a lot of songs prepared, songs that he had written at the piano. And those demo sessions were more of a matter of shaping the band arrangement around those already written songs. There were some improvisations at the demos, but none of them made the finished album. Some of them appeared as B-sides later on and stuff. There was no improvising at Abbey Road. It was all highly concentrated, tasteful playing. We were trying to play as little as possible, but with it having as much impact as possible and resonance, impact and resonance as possible.
It's so amazing, because I think you can hear that in the record. Well, you definitely can.
Reading about your history and hearing you talk about it, it's just so fascinating. And I wondered if we could just talk briefly also about your own solo projects that you do, because you put out Holiday Song in January of this year on Bandcamp, with the proceeds going to the Music Venue Trust charity, which I just felt, especially after hearing you speak about, the grassroots venues that you kind of were brought up in, what an amazing way of giving back to, the place where you kind of started out. I was just wondering, what's next for you and your and have you got, obviously we have the Absence of Light EP project coming out together shortly, but do you have other projects in the pipeline that you're able to talk to us about?
Yeah, well, I've me and my friend Nicole Atkin, she's an American singer. She comes from New Jersey. She's currently living in Nashville. She and I have been writing songs together for a long time for her solo albums. And then we found we had like a kind of some extra songs that weren't really working, so well as for her solo stuff. And she had the idea of doing a duet record. We've got that all finished. We had loads of songs and we recorded and mixed it, and now we're just looking for a label.
Okay.
Good luck to us. that's all done, and I'm dying to put it out, but it's basically good to go. And and she and I, we haven't done a lot of shows together, but we were talking just the other day about trying to make a plan to start doing some live gigs. If these aforementioned venues will only open up long enough for us to do that. It doesn't help that I'm here and she's there, but hopefully that hurdle will become a bit easier, in the coming months.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. Aside from that, I'm doing a solo album, and
Wow.
I've got some stuff just pretty much on the verge of, the first jab at it was Holiday Song. That was my very first solo record.
It's such a beautiful song, very reflective of the times that we were living through when it came out as well, which I thought was really, really lovely.
Well, thank you very much. It's weird though. I had written that song 2 years prior, and it very much not in pandemic circumstances, and it just felt right to put it out at that point. And when my wife Sarah told me about the Music Venue Trust charity, the fundraiser for the Music Venue Trust, I was like, okay, well that's the way forward is clear. I have to put this damn thing out. And
Seemed like completing of the circle when I read that. It was really cool.
It's beautiful. And also your voice sounds incredible on it. I was just so struck by...
Are you talking to me?
Yeah. No, it does.
Boy, thank you.
It sounds, I don't know, it sounds kind of, you're really
out
in
of tune.
There. No, you're really inside the song, you know? It's like the song is really alive in your voice, and it's a pleasure to hear it.
So can everyone go to Bandcamp to listen to it, or where's the best place to find you, Jim, online?
I'd say Bandcamp's good, you know. You'd put in Jim Sklavounis Bandcamp or whatever it is. I also have a website where you can find jimsklavounis.com, and you know, there's loads of stuff to listen to there, from work that I've done as a producer, work that I've done as a songwriter, band member, you know, drummer, what have you. Or you can look me up on Spotify if you must.
I've found this conversation so inspiring. So thank you so much for your time, Jim. It's been an absolute pleasure.
The pleasure's all mine. The pleasure's all mine.
You've been listening to The Detail, a podcast by me, Katie Melua.
And me, Polly Scattergood. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you. And farewell out there in podcast land.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me in my studio. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to give your support. The address is patreon.com/PollyScattergood. Thanks so much.